Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour, bringing you an in-depth view of Pope Benedict XVI's meeting with artists in the Sistine Chapel on the 21st of November. Stepping back in time to that first meeting of artists with Paul VI back in May 1964. Reading you extracts from the moving letter Pope John Paul II wrote to artists on Easter Sunday 1999. Joining one of the artists who'll be present in the Sistine Chapel on Saturday, John David Mooney, and art historian Monsignor Timothy Verdon, who shows us around the Sistine Chapel, indicating its primary meaning. And Andrea Pozzo basks in beauty. No illusions this time. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. On Saturday, 21st of November, Pope Benedict XVI meets with artists, almost 300 of them, in the Sistine Chapel. Catholics and non-Catholics alike, they're from the worlds of art, theatre, literature, dance and music. Among these, Yanni Kounellis, Peter Greenway, Martin Baker, Bill Viola, and John David Mooney, who's worked in the Vatican before, and who we'll be speaking to later on in the broadcast. The president of the Pontifical Council for Culture, Archbishop Gianfranco Ravasi, says this meeting is intended as the first of many initiatives aimed at rekindling that relationship between faith and art. Among these are plans for the Holy See to have its own pavilion at the Venice Biennale in 2011. Not commissioning art in the Renaissance sense, perhaps, but inviting artists to produce work for this venture on a specific theme still to be decided. As we know, the Vatican's interest in contemporary art was first rekindled almost half a century ago by Pope Paul VI. I'd like to invite you to join me as I step back in time, beginning by speaking to a personal friend of Paul VI, Cardinal Edmund Shoker, as well as to our cultural expert and friend, Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, who for many years worked as an official at the Pontifical Council for Culture. And of course, I'll be letting you hear Pope Paul's voice once again. But let's begin by listening to Cardinal Shoker.
There was historically that connection between the church and art, but then there was an estrangement for some time, and Paul VI wanted to recall that, to bring back that relationship that had existed for centuries.
American Cardinal Edmund Shoker knew Pope Paul VI personally. I asked him what it was in Paul VI's personality that made him such a patron of art and artists. Cardinal Shoker says it stems from a combination of great sensitivity and radiant spirituality.
It does not surprise me that he would have a great interest in art, because of his deep spirituality and because art ultimately expresses the spiritual. And I think that it'd be just a sort of natural consequence of his own deep spirituality and his ability to see beyond the material to the transcendence of everything. I think it was a natural consequence of that ability that he would have such a great interest in art.
Sono mai venuti gli artisti a Papa? È una prima volta anche questa, forse.
Have artists ever gathered around a pope like this before? Pope Paul VI's gentle voice questions the artists he's invited to join him in the Sistine Chapel. It's May 7, 1964. The occasion is unusual. A mass for artists in the cenacle of artists.
Un momento religioso proprio per noi, non come gente che sta nelle quinte, ma che viene davvero alla ribalta di...
Paul VI is out to provoke. He knows all too well that for centuries the church and art had enjoyed an extremely prolific love affair. But what he's forced to admit is that at some stage that love affair dwindled, marking a decline destined to last for almost two centuries. As he says this, his voice wavers wistfully.
Siamo sempre stati amici, ma come avviene fra parenti, come avviene anche fra amici, ci si è un po' guastati. Non abbiamo rotto,
Ma abbiamo turbato la nostra amicizia.
I was fascinated to read that speech by Pope Paul because the church had lost its way a little bit with artists. There was no more patronage in the Renaissance sense. All the energy seemed to go on stressing the mind and the consistency, the logic of what the church had to teach. Very much a world of words, whereas the images lost out.
Cultural expert Monsignor Peter Fleetwood. During that speech, the Pope says that the church abandoned artists, but the artists abandoned the church as well. Is that right?
Yeah, they'd each gone their own way. He wanted to apologise, which is a remarkable thing. You don't often hear that from a Pope. And it was a very humble, avuncular kind of speech. It was saying, the Pope's your friend. I really want you to be sure of this, that you're very welcome in the church and we should get back together. You've gone off by losing the standards that you used to hold so dear and stopped reflecting a beauty that mattered very much to the church.
Ci avete un po' abbandonato, siete andati lontani a bere ad altre fontane, la ricerca di esprimere altre cose.
The Pope's voice is hesitant and shy as he begins chastising artists for abandoning the church. But before long, the strength of the Pope's commitment to art surfaces from that silent shyness, spiraling into a cry of vehement reproval.
Dimenticate il canone fondamentale della vostra consacrazione all'espressione. Non si sa che cosa dite, non lo sapete tante volte neanche voi. Diventa un linguaggio di Babele, di confusione.
No longer does he whisper, I don't want to offend you here today, but you did lower your standards, lost sight of true inspiration. Your art became offensive to humanity. And what is the result? Confusion, a Tower of Babel.
Artists had gone their own way, in a way that really he thought the church couldn't always approve of, like not looking to standards of decency or beauty in the classic senses. The effect of different currents of thought left its mark on the church as well, and there was too much rational thinking taking over, and the thing that lost out was the emotional side, or the more explicitly artistic side in people's character.
Riconosceremo che anche noi vi abbiamo fatto tribolare.
But while Paul VI does rap artists over the knuckles, he also admits to the church's responsibility, its failure to foster art, a failure that brought the church's image as patron of art and artists to an end. Paul VI explains why. He attributes it to a clash between artists' boundless creativity and the church's imposition of styles and limiting rules and regulations in the field of art. As Paul VI insisted almost half a century ago, joy, hope, exhilaration, these are the emotions that speak to people of God. He was desperately determined in his desire to bring modern associations to a long-lost relationship between the church and art. A decade later, he would inaugurate the Gallery of Modern Art in the Vatican Museums. It was the 23rd of June, 1973. And the only great artist of the 20th century who declined to grant him one of his masterpieces was, well, Picasso. A big thank you there to my guests, Cardinal Edmund Schoker and Monsignor Peter Fleetwood. This meeting between Pope Benedict XVI and artists also marks 10 years since that moving letter Pope John Paul II wrote to artists on Easter Sunday 1999. Extracts of which will be read out in the Sistine Chapel on Saturday. I don't as yet know which ones these are, but I've picked some for you to listen to. Sean Patrick Lovett reads them for us.
No one can sense more deeply than you artists, ingenious creators of beauty that you are, something of the pathos with which God at the dawn of creation looked upon the work of his hands. A glimmer of that feeling has shone so often in your eyes, when, like the artists of every age, captivated by the sounds and words, colours and shapes, you have admired the work of your inspiration, sensing in it some echo of the mystery of creation with which God, the sole creator of all things, has wished in some way to associate with you.
Pope John Paul II also highlights how society needs artists.
Obedient to their inspiration in creating works both worthwhile and beautiful, they not only enrich the cultural heritage of each nation and of all humanity, but they also render an exceptional social service in favour of the common good.
And the late Pope stressed how in the past, when few could read or write, representations of the Bible were a concrete mode of catechesis, reminding us of the words of Saint Gregory the Great, who once wrote,
"Painting is employed in churches so that those who cannot read or write may at least read on the walls what they cannot decipher on the page."
But whether people can or cannot read or write, Pope John Paul stresses in this letter how there exists a fruitful alliance between the gospel and art, going beyond what the senses perceive, striving to interpret reality's hidden mystery.
All artists experience the unbridgeable gap which lies between the work of their hands and dazzling perfection of the beauty glimpsed in the ardour of the creative movement. Believers find nothing strange in this. They know they've had a momentary glimpse of the abyss of light which has had its original wellspring in God.
I read this particular passage to one of the artists who's travelled from the States to meet with Pope Benedict XVI in the Sistine Chapel on Saturday 21st. He's John David Mooney. I asked him how he related to these words. Do you relate to that at all?
Totally. I work without knowing what I'm going to do or where I'm going to go with that work. And the only way that I can really come to that point is in preparation, through prayer, through contemplation, through completely emptying myself and letting the Spirit guide that work. It's amazing. And I think you'll find any artist, whether they are of faith or not of faith, the realization of the work comes outside of their control. It is outside of that. It is a force that you really can't stop if you've opened yourself to it.
John David Mooney, you're an internationally recognized artist. That's why you've been invited here in the Vatican. And I believe you have art that you can't carry around with you.
Some of it is both ephemeral, which disappears, and others are so large that they can't be transported.
Yeah, I read you once did a 133-foot long rooftop light sculpture in Los Angeles.
That's right. It's called Star Steps, and it sat at the corner of Hollywood Freeway and Sunset Boulevard. It was Hollywood.
And then I read, too, that you did light sculptures in the Chicago Tribune Tower. I've actually seen pictures of that.
Oh, good.
As I said, it's not art that you can carry around with you. How would you describe yourself as an artist?
Actually, the easiest way is just an artist, because I do encompass a lot of different disciplines. I am not committed to one material or one way of working, a repetition of one form over another. Rather, I try to find the voids in the urban setting, in society, and fill those voids and give a moment of beauty, of arrestation for thought of things other than the day-to-day problems that people have. So they have an excuse to celebrate just for a moment, even.
Where do you draw your inspiration from?
Oh, well, it comes from all sources. The world of science is a major one because they communicate with artists, particularly the physicists, the astrophysicists. The works that I did at Castel Gandolfo were
at the observatory
were requested by the scientists for a conference that they were holding. So I work in response to others' requests. I never know exactly what it's going to be. In fact, I start in the void.
How do you feel about this meeting with Pope Benedict on Saturday?
Highly honored to be invited. Thrilled also to come back to Rome. I feel like I'm coming home again. Pope Paul VI's call for artists in 1964, I was still in America. I was working as an artist, and the work that I was doing was really based upon a religious subject matter at the time. In fact, I had just created an important crucifixion, maybe a month or two before Pope Paul's meeting with the artists. And it was purchased by the Museum of Modern Art in New York. They don't buy religious art. So this was amazing that this happened, and that encouraged me to continue doing more work. And his call for artists was strong enough to me that I came a few months later and covered the final year of the council as an artist in 1965. Then I had full access to all the meetings, met weekly with Cardinal Sunens, and at the close of the council, they celebrated Jacques Maritain, who was Paul VI's great friend and who had been my hero all through college. His responsibility to the artists of society, Maritain wrote, has been my guidebook. And I felt, wow, this is wonderful. This Pope, who I met when I was an undergraduate as a freshman, when Cardinal Montini, came to Notre Dame in America for an honorary degree with President Eisenhower. So it was a full circle with Pope Paul VI. And coming back now with Pope Benedict XVI, it's like completing that circle.
And while my thanks there go to artist John David Mooney, what I'd like to do now is share with you a chat I once had with Monsignor Timothy Verdon, Professor of Sacred Art at the Theological Faculty of Central Italy. A chat which focused around the primary meaning of the Sistine Chapel, where Pope Benedict XVI will meet with artists. So don't miss this introduction as the Monsignor opens the doors to the Sistine for us. There's some beautiful images in the Sistine Chapel. Michelangelo really gave him his all to those frescoes, no?
Yes.
Is there anything you find particularly meaningful?
One fresco in the chapel that I consider to be a key to understanding the program, the theological program that Michelangelo was developing, is the figure positioned in the most conspicuous place, that is to say, the prophet positioned directly above the papal altar, the prophet that those entering the chapel, as Michelangelo expected us to enter, from the Sala Regia, that is to say, in procession from the Vatican Palace and not through the museum corridors, those entering through the main door and not the little back door through which today tourists enter, would have seen first. It's also the biggest and most dramatic of the prophet figures. It is the prophet Jonah. Jonah, seated directly above the papal altar, is turning dramatically on his seat to gaze right up into the first of the scenes in the center of the ceiling depicting creation. It is the scene of God separating light from darkness. Jonah, from where he sits, turns to look right up at this, and it's clear that he's absolutely amazed.
Bewildered.
Bewildered, practically shocked. And so the question is, what does this dramatic and even disturbing figure, this muscular, powerful, even morally powerful man who shows every sign of total disorientation as he gazes up at the Creator God at the very beginning of creation, what does this mean? I've explained it this way, and I think that anyone who has even a slight acquaintance with the chapel will remember some of the things I'm saying. When you come in that principal door, you come in really at the end of the Genesis story. You come in under the scene of Noah and his sons offering sacrifice. Then there's the flood in which God punished sinners, really destroyed sinful humanity. Then you have Noah and his sons offering sacrifice in the third scene. The very first scene is the sin of one of Noah's sons. The whole Sistine Chapel ceiling is under the sign of sin. After the stories of Noah, the first of the stories of Adam and Eve is the sin of our first parents. Why is sin so important? Sin is important in the Sistine Chapel because the only real power the Pope has is the power of the keys, the power to give the world God's forgiveness. That's what the keys stand for. Pope Julius II, who commissioned the chapel, had been papal penitentiary. It's the office today covered by the American Cardinal James Francis Stafford. Pope Julius II had had that same office under his uncle, Pope Sixtus IV. He knew about sin. He knew about the problems of sin and forgiveness. As Pope, he was in charge of distributing the forgiveness of Christ to the world. So sin is important. Jonah is put in that central position because Jonah, as a prophet, had been sent to the sinful pagan city of Nineveh to preach forgiveness. And he had not wanted to go because he said, God is too good, these people may repent and God will forgive them. And I don't think those pagans should be forgiven. So Jonah tries to escape. Everyone knows how from the belly of the whale he is brought back and he finally agrees to go to Nineveh. He begins to preach with a heavy heart, thinking they'll never repent, but they do. From the king down to the humblest citizen, they put on sackcloth and ashes. And when Jonah sees that God does not therefore destroy the city, he's very put out. And he goes outside of Nineveh and sits on a hillside and sulks. And it's very hot, the book of Jonah says, and he gets more and more angry. And when night comes, God plants a seed and lets a tree grow. And Michelangelo shows us the leaves of this tree in the background of the Jonah fresco. And so the next day, Jonah's a bit mollified because he has the shade of the tree. The following night, God sends a worm to destroy the root of the tree. And so the third morning, Jonah wakes up and his tree isn't there. And now he is absolutely fit to be tied. He's absolutely furious that he doesn't even have the tree to give him shade. And it's at that point that God intervenes and says, Jonah, do you have any right to be angry? Because a tree that you neither planted nor watered, and which grew up in a night and then perished in another night, is no more. If you have a right to be angry about that, how should I feel about losing this great city with all of its humans and its animals? And so Jonah understands that the God who created all things does not want to destroy them. That the just God who asks for repentance for sins asks for that repentance in order to save what he has created, not to destroy it. Jonah understands that he was wrong in wanting to see sinners punished, and that the God who created all human beings and even the animals wants only the salvation of his creatures. There you have an extraordinary example of a highly focused catechesis, if you like, directed at the Pope and his court, directed specifically at the people who would have used that chapel in the 16th century, who would have had little difficulty in grasping the sense of that message.
But Michelangelo was not a theologian. He had theologians to help him better understand the story of creation. Is that right?
That's certainly true. Michelangelo writings claims at one point that he was allowed to do what he wanted in the Sistine Chapel, and that's simply not credible because it was too central, too important, too official a place. Michelangelo could interpret the themes that were given him according to his artistic talent, but the themes were certainly spelled out for him. So here we're talking about a very rich and focused theological program that was given to Michelangelo, which he could understand because in his youth, he probably was very close to people who dealt with these subjects. His elder brother was a Dominican friar. He had heard Savonarola preach. One of his teachers was the canon of the Florence Cathedral, Marsilio Ficino, who was also a Neoplatonic philosopher. So Michelangelo had more than a smattering of this kind of information, but certainly the great lines of the program were laid out for him by court theologians of Julius.
And our thanks there go to Monsignor Timothy Verdon, Professor of Sacred Art at the Theological Faculty of Central Italy, based in Florence, for sharing with us his expertise. Finally, This week, here in Rome, the Pontifical Gregorian University, together with the Austrian Historical Institute and the Biblioteca Herziana, organised a conference focusing on the figure of Andrea Pozzo, the Jesuit artist and architect of illusions, who died 3 centuries ago, one who's left us a sublime artistic legacy. I'd like to add in a special way in Roman churches, perhaps the best known of which is that of the ceiling of the Church of the Gesù, or that of the nearby St. Ignatius, where he depicts the teeming heavenly scene of the apotheosis of St. Ignatius. That's what most Romans or tourists know. What they don't know is one of Rome's best-kept secrets, his presence at the venerable English College here in Rome. I spoke to someone who knows everything about that. She's Professor Carol Richardson of the Open University in the United Kingdom, who in a few moments will, by the way, unveil an ulterior secret connected to the garden at the college. You get drawn into the artwork of Andrea Pozzo in the college. What is this artwork?
One's a beautiful Assumption of the Virgin in the Martyrs Chapel. Now, this is actually not very far above your head, but Andrea Pozzo has been so clever with the space, you feel as though you were one of the apostles looking up at the Assumption. In the refectory, there's a representation of George and the Dragon. Andrea Pozzo is so clever with the manipulation of space. He's actually tilted the scene in 2 dimensions perspectivally, so you don't have to crane your neck to see it. The horse and St. George sitting on it, if you like, comes towards you just as you go into the space. It's the immediacy. He makes the most of actually quite a small and limited space.
He's a master of illusion. In the English college, there are no trompe-l'œil or things like that, are there?
Well, actually, and this is something that I'm going to reveal for the first time, it's a fresco in the garden, and that is a trompe-l'œil, a representation taken from a treatise on perspective.
Well, I heard Professor Richardson toss off the words treatise on perspective, as if we should all know about that. Well, naturally we should, but as it happens, we're not all learned Inner Circle Pozzo scholars. So realising this was an essential passage, I asked about this document. It's very famous, this treatise on perspective, isn't it?
Yes, and it's actually been reissued as part of the events around the conference and the anniversary of the death of Andrea Pozzo, which all of these events are commemorating. But one of the scenes, and Andrea Pozzo describes it in the treatise as being the kind of scene that you could use for a religious festival. So you would set it up in a church and it would draw you into the space, would represent just tiny little figures. You'd have to crane to see the figures in the middle of the architecture of Christ healing the lame man. But Pozzo, because of his use of space, he draws you into this. But this same scene was copied. Pozzo says in the treatise that you could also use it at the end of a long view or in a garden. And it's actually used in exactly that way in the English college.
But how has it been kept all these years if it's out in the open?
That's one of the problems. It hasn't really been kept. And in fact, right on top of it now is repositioned one of the Gothic windows from the 15th century Church of the English College, which I think was only actually put on top of the fresco in the 1960s. It's a real shame. It's in a very poor condition. You can see it when it rains because the colours of the frescoes stand out from the wall again.
You were listening there to Professor Carol Richardson of the Open University in the UK. You'll be hearing more from her at the same time next week. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening. Laudetur Jesus Christus.